The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Thursday, December 30th, 2021.
We're almost there.
We're almost there at the end of the year, and as such, on this special episode of The Majority Report, we look back on 2021. It's a pre-recorded... It would be silly for us to have just come in to do the intro live, right? And then play a best of?
It would be silly, but it would totally be in keeping with the way you
totally
conduct yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. In character. Because yeah. We just give and give and give. And you take. You people, you take. Take, take, take.
You take our content.
Ladies and gentlemen, today on the program, we have a best of from the date. October 15th, 2021, Representative Ilhan Omar, Minnesota's 5th Congressional District. She's also the whip of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. She wrote a book, This Is What America Looks Like, My Journey from Refugee to Congresswoman. And we were talking about, Biden's immigration policy. I think there is... I don't know. I think there's, we have a lot of Trumpistas still within their departments. And I think sometimes the Biden administration, I think there are probably some things that are their policy and the other things that like become their policy because they don't necessarily exercise the will or the control over their bureaucracy or haven't been able to catch up with that stuff. Nevertheless, the end product is... subpar, to say the least, in many respects, really indecent. But we talked to Congresswoman Ilhan Omar about that. And then we actually just coincidentally, we rarely do this, but on that same show.
Oh, it was the same day?
Yeah, we had Ben Glebe on.
Wow, what a show we had that day.
Who was a comedian who sat down with Charlie Kirk, had a little debate. So this is all going to be super fun for you, ladies and gentlemen. It is the second to last best of show of 2021. So enjoy this one. And tomorrow we got another special mega show for you.
Last day of the year.
Last day of the year. Good riddance. But here is that interview with Ilhan Omar and Ben Glebe. We are back, Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on The Majority Report. Joining us now, it is a pleasure to welcome to the program Congresswoman for Minnesota's 5th District and author of This Is What America Looks Like, My Journey from Refugee to Congresswoman, coming out in paperback shortly. Ilhan Omar, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Congratulations on the paperback. Let's start, actually. On the topic of refugees, we obviously have had over the course of really the past 3 or 4 months, I guess, two major in terms of what garnered some news issues with refugees. First, obviously, from Afghanistan. Do you have a sense of where we're at in terms of the Afghan refugees, when it comes to paroling them? My understanding is you cannot apply for refugee status unless you're in the country. And there is simply not enough visas and perhaps maybe methods of giving visas to Afghan refugees to get them in the country so they can apply for refugee status. The Biden administration, my understanding is, could simply parole them and allow them to come in at least temporarily, then apply for the status. Do you know what the status of what's going on with that issue?
Yeah, so I think you've got a part of it right. So everyone who has entered the country has received humanitarian parole, which is what you were saying that the president has the authority to do. So everyone we've lifted from... Afghanistan in that rescue effort, whether they have gone to the military bases here inside of our borders or they've been in other countries, have all received humanitarian parole if they already didn't have a status. established that that would allow them to enter this country. And then from that humanitarian parole status that they have means that the ones that qualify for refugee status, which is very different than, you know, when we talk about people fleeing and all of that stuff, we say these are refugees, but refugee is a actual category, which is why people often will say like Ilhan is a refugee in Congress, because there's a specific category that allows you to be under that refugee status. And majority of the people obviously don't have that status because they weren't processed as refugees. And so one of my colleagues from Massachusetts, Seth, I'm going to say his last name wrong.
Moulton,
thank you. he introduced legislation to make sure that that refugee category could be applied to the Afghan refugees that were entering our country. And that came out of a conversation that we had in one of the security briefings that we got when we had the secretary come and talk to us. And so that bill eventually passed as an amendment to the to an emergency supplemental that we did, the CR. And it is, I'm assuming now, the law of the land.
Okay, that's good. That's good to hear in terms of like getting some status, permanent, or at least some status and where it's settled, I guess.
Yeah, and the settlement of that status in itself allows for the folks who have come to our country or who would eventually come to our country from Afghanistan to actually receive the refugee resettlement support, because if you have only humanitarian parole or you enter as an asylum seeker, you don't have the infrastructure that folks who enter this country as a refugee to be resettled in the United States, like my family did. And that is really important for people who are starting from scratch and don't have family members here.
Let's talk about the what we saw recently in terms of the influx of Haitian migrants who did so in the wake of two massive disasters that were at least function at least in part of a hurricane and an earthquake, and an assassination of the president in Haiti. And this is on top of, I think, you know, our listeners, I think, are pretty familiar with the history of Haiti and America and intervention, et cetera. I'm curious as to your thoughts about how the Biden administration is dealing with these Haitian migrants, and perhaps, you know, why they are taking the tact on this that they are. I have some theories, but I'm curious as to yours.
You know, I mean, as you remember, Sam, when the president ran, he promised decency in dealing with people at our borders. He spoke about how he was appalled by the way in which the Trump administration was dealing with migrants who were showing up in distressful situations at our border. And, you know, in the most shameful way has continued to do the same thing. Instead of rolling back a lot of the policies of the Trump era, they're actually defending them in the courts and have in some cases actually expanded those. And so what we've been calling for the president to do is to provide humanitarian parole for Haitian migrants because of what you were just stating. These are people who are fleeing political stability. Many of them have transitioned through many different countries. And because of the hurricanes that continue to take place in Haiti and a lot of the economic devastations the country has gone through, many of these people obviously need are desperate help. You know, it's sad that an administration that has run to uphold international law is continuing to disregard the fact that people have an international right to seek asylum and they deserve to be dealt with in the most humane way. As someone who sought asylum in Kenya, a country that is much poorer than the United States, you know, the Kenyans recognized that I had an international right to seek asylum and help provide refuge for me and my family and, you know, hundreds of thousands of Somalis who were fleeing civil war and continue to do that as people come to their border. And so there's a lot of examples around the world, whether it is, you know, countries like Lebanon or Turkey or, you know, other countries like Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, who provide assistance to people that are coming to their borders seeking asylum. It's shameful that we live in the United States and, you know, have forced other countries to uphold international law and we're not willing to.
Well, I want to ask you specifically about the usage of Title 42 in this area, because we hear a lot of conservatives concerned about government overreach when it comes to COVID, if we're talking about mask mandates or vaccine mandates. But in my opinion, this usage of Title 42, carrying over the Biden administration, this Trump era policy under the guise of pandemic response, I mean, it's clearly using the pandemic in order to circumvent traditional processes for asylum seekers. I mean, what is your stance specifically on Title 42 and the Biden administration's usage of it?
That's what I was talking about. I don't think that we should have Title 42. I don't think the administration should continue to defend it in the courts. It is one of the most abhorrent, you know, Trump era policies. It is not okay to use the pandemic to disregard people's international rights to seek asylum. You know, we're living under a pandemic that threatens the lives of everyone, regardless of what country you're born in, and to abuse folks who are actually being subjected to a political crisis, a humanitarian crisis, and desperately need our help to a policy that will victimize them more. It just seems really shameful and unjust.
Well, Congressman, let me ask you, why do you think the administration is pursuing this strategy? I guess. I mean, I understand the idea that maybe they're just simply afraid of this as a political issue. And you can tell me whether you agree or not with that idea. But speaking just specifically on the politics of it, do you get the sense that they're under the impression that it makes a difference what they do in terms of the way that it's going to be characterized by foes of immigration, by people who are inspired by racism, perhaps, to say that we shouldn't have Haitian immigrants in the country, or, I mean, whatever it is that inspires these people who have a problem with refugees or immigrants. I mean, what do you think their motivation is, and what do you think of even granting them that motivation, the way they're approaching this?
I mean, I don't think it's politically motivated because in many ways I think it would be politically helpful to the administration to do away with Trump era policies, obviously, because there are so many people who had faith in them and elected them just because of that reason, right? That was the promise that was made. But I do think that secondarily, you know, we have to remember, right? There's just so many systems that have been broken and the process in trying to stitch everything back together can take some time. And I do think in my conversations that there is a legitimate concern about the spread of the pandemic as we're seeing surges. And I believe that obviously that they have to work really hard and fast to address you know, those concerns so that they can actually carry out a humane immigration policy.
So I'm sorry, just to clarify. So you think that this is they're buying time to rev up a sort of to fix the administrative state on some level, or is it that this is really more a function of how to reassemble a system that had been sort of, I think, deliberately targeted to be disassembled?
Yeah, I mean, I think the assembling of that system has been just a bit harder, I think, for the administration than they actually thought. I mean, if you think back to the promise that they made to increase the refugee resettlement numbers, and how they started out saying, "Oh, we're only going to do you know, few." Right. We're going to do like 20,000. We're not going to do the 100 that we promised. And now we're realizing only, you know, a little over 7,000 has actually been, resettled in the country. It does speak to the way in which these systems were dismantled. But I don't think that for us that care about having a just and humane system, those excuses of the system being broken should be enough. We should continue to urge, we should continue to speak with the rigor that we did with the last administration. We should continue to advocate for the humane system that we know that we can. We should also, you know, continue to fight the xenophobic tendencies that continue to show up whenever immigration is discussed. We have to remember that our country does both have a history of being a beacon of hope and welcoming immigrants at our border, but we also have a xenophobic history of turning people away, and even when they enter our country, treating them in a bigoted way. And so this sort of duality has always existed, and we certainly had the last president take advantage of that and dismantle the system in ways that it hasn't been dismantled before. And so there is, I think, a part of me that wants to understand that, to give this administration the acknowledgement that there is a lot of work to be done, but also remind them that promises need to be kept. And if people are told that you're going to be a more humane president and a more humane administration, then you need to do that.
I want to turn to your renewed calls along with a number of other lawmakers, including Representative Ayanna Pressley, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and others, to get the Biden administration to kind of pin down their response to student debt. They have said for months and months that they're looking into their administrative authority and their ability to cancel debt. But a lot of scholars have said that they essentially can cancel debt with the stroke of a pen via executive action. What are you urging for the Biden administration to do in this area?
Yeah, I mean, there was obviously a promise of a memo that is supposed to be released, giving guidelines on whether he does actually have the executive authority to do so. And the administration, every time we've asked for them to carry out their promise to help cancel student debt, have said, you know, we're waiting for this memo to come out. We want to hear the advice of experts. And, you know, I think Senator Warren and Senator Chuck Schumer have joined us in that effort of saying, we know you have the authority, you can do this. But since they keep hiding behind this memo, we're like, let's see what the memo actually says, so that we can continue to engage in a conversation that is productive.
What's happening with this memo? I mean, are they making homemade parchment? Like, why is this supposed to be here in April? Like, what? I mean, is your sense that the memo they're not releasing? I mean, it seems to me if the memo says he doesn't have the authority, they would release the memo.
Yeah.
I mean. Do you, let me,
I feel like you know something, Sam.
Well, I mean, I just know how long it takes to write a memo.
That is where we're at right now, right? We have made the asks. We've obviously introduced resolutions and all of these things. I didn't reintroduce my legislation to cancel student debt because we're all eagerly awaiting to hear this opinion in this memo. And so we want to know what the holdup is. Why doesn't the administration want to let us know what the memo actually says?
Do you think that they are waiting for the outcome of reconciliation, of the Build Back Better, of the current sort of legislative dramas to resolve in some way before they start to deploy the unilateral authority that the president has in this area and in other areas? Or am I being a little, what is it, Pollyannish? Is that the right term? Like, am I being a little bit too optimistic about that, or do you think that's what's going on?
I do love your spirit in this. I can speculate on what their the political strategy on this is. I hope you're right. I hope that they're willing to do this and actually just waiting for the right time to do it. Because whether it comes this month, next month, or end of the year, for the millions of people who desperately need this relief, it will still mean the same thing to them. I just actually believe that they are or were maybe hoping for a different kind of memo than the one that they have right now, and maybe they went back to the drawing board to try to find a different opinion.
A new memo.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you keep rewriting it, it's going to take a long time for it to happen. All right. Well, let's speaking of memos and reconciliation, I think it was the Progressive Caucus released a memo in terms of what they're looking for from reconciliation. There were four principles that were outlined in that context. In short, and correct me if I'm wrong, there is a call for shorter timeline on these programs so that they can be fully funded, but for a shorter period of time, essentially challenging a 2024 or 2025 Congress to not reauthorize it or to reauthorize it or the president, et cetera. Two would be quick deployment so that there is presumably some political benefit, and so the people understand what's happening. There was a lot of talk about how long it took the ACA to deliver, to the extent that it delivered benefits for people. It took a long time for that to happen. Three, that they be universal, which I take to mean no means testing, and four, that the commitment to racial equality within the Build Back Better bill be maintained. Is that essentially what the Progressive Caucus is looking for? And if so, how do they leverage, to the extent that they have any power, how do they leverage to make sure that that happens?
Yeah, I mean, we have had the votes, right, to deliver a full agenda out of the House. We obviously have been running a tight ship in the Progressive Caucus to try to make sure that we count the votes in a way that is productive for us to engage in actual negotiations. And so we know that there is no piece of legislation that can pass the House without having our priorities and without fulfilling the four points that you had just outlined. We've always maintained, right, the top line number that we are negotiating is based on our priorities being funded. And now if the top line number needs to change, we still want these priorities to be funded. We can live with them being funded a shorter period of time.
Do you think that there was a strategic error made in so much focus on the top line number I mean, my understanding is, I mean, it's been reported that Chuck Schumer was aware that Joe Manchin had a different top line number 4 months ago in July. But yet, let me ask you this. Were you made aware of that number? Do you know whether members of in the House were made aware that Joe Manchin had a number? Because it seems like maybe the idea at that point is to not necessarily tout the 3.5 if there is an awareness that somebody has a different number and that person is, you know, the baby president on some level or something. How much awareness was there in the House of Joe Manchin's number?
I think outside of what we've read in the news, I don't think there was an awareness. And we were all working out of the assumption that this was agreed upon number because, as you recall, the budget resolution itself had to be passed out of the Senate to be sent to us so that we can mark up the bill and, you know, formulate it to have the actual policies in them. And so I still don't understand how Manchin and Sinema decided that they were going to vote yes on a budget resolution with a $3.5 trillion. And then months later, after we've all been working, are just like, oh, I didn't really realize that that is the number I kind of was agreeing to. And that, you know, all the work that you were going to do was going to mean nothing. And I still don't know what number I want and what policies I actually agree with. I mean, Manchin is still willing to have a conversation about policy. We haven't heard much from Sinema. So it's hard to have a conversation with people who sort of flip-flop all the time.
Well, she said she'll only negotiate with the White House, right? So, I mean, how is that? How does the sausage get made if you're unsure of what ingredients are going into said sausage by Chef Sinema? I mean, it makes your job quite difficult.
I mean, it's also really interesting, right? If we're going with a chef situation where your negotiations aren't happening with your co-chefs in the kitchen, but you're somehow negotiating with the people who are coming to eat the food. I just don't recognize or refuse to recognize someone who doesn't want to negotiate with the actual legislators, but wants to negotiate with the administration that's not one voting on the bill or writing the bill.
Stepping outside the restaurant metaphor for a moment.
I don't think we did it very well.
It's my fault from the outset.
Do you have I think Manchin has shown, at least it appears from you know, the shadows of this stuff that we see, that there's at least some willingness to negotiate. And we've just gone through the whole chef metaphor to explain that's not necessarily the case with Senator Sinema. Do you have a message? What would be your message to Senator Sinema at this point? I think she's in Europe at this moment, fundraising, as far as I know from the reporting. But in the event that she happens to tune in to the program today, what would be your message to her?
Nothing. I think she's heard enough from her constituents and the people that she's actually supposed to represent. If that hasn't been enough for her, I don't know what I can say to her.
Do you worry that the moderates who have been slow walking the Build Back Better bill, that the so-called moderates, I guess, that people like Sinema and Manchin are going to undercut enthusiasm when we get to the midterm elections?
I don't think so. I think if we are able to deliver and get them on board to fulfill the promises that we've made to our collective constituents, I think that that's going to be enough. I think to most people, what somebody else does is quite irrelevant than what their representative is doing. And I think that there is a lot of us who have been both on the moderate and progressive side outside of the few conservative Democrats that we have that have actually shown that Democrats don't just say they are the party of the people, but for the first time are willing to fight for the people.
Do you feel the weight of that responsibility in the CPC? Because it's really kind of a bit of a new dawn for the way that the Congressional Progressive Caucus is wielding its power. I mean, the fate of this massive agenda is really with progressives in the CPC holding the line under Pramila Jayapal's leadership, where I feel like the muscle has been flexed a lot more.
Yeah, I mean, it is, you know, interesting to be the caucus that has been disregarded by Democrats for the most part to now be the caucus that is saving the agenda of the Democratic president and the agenda of a Democratic speaker and a Democratic majority leader. It's a bit strange, but we proudly carry it because this is an agenda that we collectively believe in. It's an agenda that the Progressive Caucus and our base has been pushing for and has been asking for a really long time. It obviously doesn't go as far as we all want it to be, but it gets us closer to that goalpost.
Well, I mean, talk a little bit about the dynamics that have changed in that regard, because I think we spoke to Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez about a year ago, I think it was. I can't really remember, but I think it was probably about a year ago. She had at that point was talking about reforms that. That you were looking for. By you, I mean, I think the members of the squad, the fellow progressives within the Progressive Caucus, to make the Progressive Caucus actually progressive. And both in terms of like trying to define what that meant and not allowing the Progressive Caucus to simply be like a good housekeeping stamp of approval, but it actually required some components to it, but also, you know, how to wield power in the first part. Is there any, I mean, when someone now signs up to be a member of the Progressive Caucus, is there any talk within the caucus of saying you can sign up to be, you don't just get to choose the title. There are certain litmus tests that we have in terms of positions. Is that in the works in some way? I mean, I think it's impressive that we had 50, you know, to the extent that we knew the exact number. By we, I mean us, not you. To the extent that we knew the real number, or at least that we knew the number that was being communicated, it was, you know, over 50, but there's over 100 members of the Progressive Caucus. So what of those other 50? Or 40 or 30, whatever that number is, is there a desire within the caucus to make the caucus maybe not as big, but as more cohesive?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when we came into Congress, a lot of us were proposing, you know, different kind of reforms that should be made. There were some that were proposing what you're suggesting of making it smaller and more cohesive. And some of us, including myself, thought, you know, we could keep whatever number that's out there with actual guidelines like other ideological caucuses have of what makes you a member of the Progressive Caucus. How often do you need to vote with us in order for you to maintain your status within the caucus? What policies do you have to agree to support in order for you to have membership? And, you know, whether you are endorsed or not, when you come into Congress, can you join without going through a screening and an approval process? And so the changes that we've made are along the lines of what I just said. You know, there is a certain percentage of votes that you have to take with us. Only if we are, if we have whipped on that vote, right? Like majority of the votes that we take are not things that the Progressive Caucus or any ideological caucus is whipping on, or even just the whole caucus is whipping on. They're just given majority of the stuff that we take, majority of the votes that we take. But for the ones that are of value, if we whip on a vote and we decide that we're voting a yes or a no, there is a certain percentage that you have to be voting with us in order to have a good standing with the caucus. There's obviously, you know, all of these bills that you have to agree to support in order to be part of the caucus. There's a certain number of meetings that you have to come to every month. There is a strategy that you have to support that's put forth by the caucus. And it drastically has shifted the cohesive ways in which we work together. You know, I was the whip my first term last cycle, and it was a really painful process, I'll tell you. I really was confused about why some people were progressive or were in the Progressive Caucus, and how we could justify their membership, and the lack of accountability was bizarre to me. I used to be the assistant minority leader when I was in the Minnesota House, and there was some accountability, and there, you know, there's just no accountability. And so once we've made the changes, obviously there is a higher turnout to the meeting. So everybody, you know, can be part of the debate. We can make decisions together. There's a faster response to my whip efforts. There is a cohesive way in which, you know, our deputy Katie Porter, our chairwoman Chayapal, and myself work together in our teams. So it's just it's a very much more effective caucus. You know, my whip deputies and their staff are excellent. We just do things differently, and it shows.
Just wrapping up here.
I will say the number was more than 50.
Okay.
Ooh.
Yeah, I appreciate that. and I'm going to assume you're not going to tell me what that percentage is either. But all right. So with that said, I mean, just lastly, you know, what has been the reaction in the larger Democratic caucus to this shift? I mean, because this feels like the first indication. It's really the first opportunity, probably too, in many respects, for this sort of revamped Progressive Caucus to emerge. What do you anticipate will be the implications of this, and what was the reaction to this? I mean, because we should just say that it's ironic that there's that many members of the Progressive Caucus who wanted that moniker, but yet this is a caucus that has been, and the caucus has allowed it, completely ignored in the context of legislating. This, in my recollection, that, you know, goes back a couple of decades, is the first time that I've seen like this type of situation where the people who wanted that, you know, wanted to break the deal about the bipartisan bill lost, and or at least have lost up to this point. What was the reactions, and what do you think the implications are going to be going forward?
I mean, I think the reaction has been quite positive, because in many ways, outside of, you know, this cohesive strategy that the Progressive Caucus has carried out, part of our strategy has also been to do outreach To other ideological caucuses about the bills that we support and why we think that it would be beneficial for them to be on board with us. And so, you know, with the help of people like Katie Porter, who's a frontliner, but a progressive and a bold progressive, because she understands how to communicate some of these policies to her district, she's able to maintain her progressive status and you know, still represent this district that is a swing district. And we've been able to gain the support of so many others that are not part of our caucus to be, you know, with us in the strategy that we have developed in regards to the reconciliation piece. And she's also encouraged other frontline members that are part of the Progressive Caucus to be in the forefront of this advocacy work that we do within the larger caucus. We've also had, you know, frank conversations with different chairs and others who are in leadership who, you know, sometimes used to have tensions around their leadership positions and being, you know, in support of the Progressive Caucus's policies and point of views when it came to negotiating. And so now we sort of have our chairs that are part of the Progressive Caucus, people who are in leadership fighting for these progressive values in these rooms. And so it's not just the chairwoman or the deputy or me and others that are part of the executive team.
That's interesting. And I imagine part of that outreach also involves some fundraising as well.
Sure.
Okay.
That is, I think, part of politics. You can't do anything without it. And, you know, majority of us, even you know, a lot of the chairs and others are starting to rely on grassroots fundraising, which means, you know, that there is a lot of that inside strategy that we can continue to deploy, and people can understand how meaningful it is for them and how much it takes away their anxiety of trying to appease, you know, special interest groups, because there's less anxiety when you're appeasing your constituency and the people that have honored you to be their voice in Congress than, you know, when you're trying to appease special interest groups and lobbyists. There's something a little icky about that.
And the squad's ability to do that kind of fundraising in mass is probably, you know, makes them take you a little more seriously, I'd imagine.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I think there's people outside of the squad, like Katie Porter and others, who have found a lot more success than, you know, someone like myself have. There are different efforts that people put into fundraising, and a lot of people spend a lot of money to raise money, and you know, it shows, and I think it's giving other members who are hesitant about that, who hate the fact that they spend so much time on the phones, an incentive to engage with the base and do more of a grassroots work than be stuck in dark rooms making deals that nobody really in their constituency benefits from.
Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. So wait, do we have Ben?
Yeah, we're marathoning in this.
Yeah. Ben Glebe is here. And this is, well, let's wait for Ben to come on. Ben is a comedian, an actor, writer. Right, Ben?
Correct.
And and now a slayer of Charlie Kirk. But, you know, I got to say this. I remember seeing your stuff on the College Network in like early aughts. I did a lot of work with the guys who started Burly Bear and Broadway Video at that time, you know, back in the 90s. And you know, 2003, 2004, I was still sort of in the comedy world. And so I was watching this stuff. And I remember you, like, I was reading it and I'm like, yes, that's where I remember seeing you from. But
National Lampoon Network back in the day took over for Brittany Bear and Broadway.
Exactly. And and so it's funny to see you now. We're it's many years later. Well, let's just start with this. How did you end up debating Charlie Kirk?
In all the years since my National Lampoon days, I've gone on to do a lot of things kind of in a mixed splinter direction in my life, maybe one that I should choose a lane that would help me progress faster in my career. But part of it is very fun, light entertainment, like being on Chelsea Lately for years and hosting my game show Idiot Test. And then part of it has been a bit of political punditry and trying to hold some of these jerks to account that try to have opinions that advance themselves while keeping other people down that just don't seem to have humanity as any part of it. And so I've done a lot of that. I used to be a CNN correspondent. I've been co-host on the Young Turks. I was on NPR, on a comedic show on NPR, doing political commentary for 7 years. And I even ran for president in the 2020 election. I don't know if you know it, because a lot of the more fringe campaigns were just not given any airtime, but we broke through a bit. We ended up as the 15th highest fundraising Democratic campaign when the campaign ended. So I have some political bona fides, and I speak out all the time. And I think Charlie Kirk probably knew a little bit of that, but also maybe thought he had an easy target debating a comedian. And I think that didn't work out too well for him.
No, it didn't. Now, we played the moment that went really viral. We played that the other day just to, drive people to see the full debate. But that's when you you pulled out a picture, a photograph. I guess maybe it was a photocopy of a photograph. And it was a picture of a fetus. And you said to Charlie, do you really think this is a person, a human being? And he said, yes, I do. And you said,
without a doubt.
And then it turned out to be a dolphin that he was looking at, a dolphin fetus, we should say.
That's correct. You definitely played it, because in the comments, your people are calling me Dolphin King. So they've
there
definitely
you are. There you are.
Yeah, then we've had Tiger King, and now we have Dolphin King.
My favorite part was when he said after that, like, you mislabeled it. And he just, I think, was so sort of embarrassed that he couldn't really get the fact that that at that stage of development, we are not talking about a person. I mean, it is, I am of the mind that it is life, but so isn't a plant. I mean, sure. Let's be honest. The tree is life, and an embryo is life. Although it is not, I mean, it is so dependent on its host, but you know, viruses are dependent on their host too. And that is, there's life there too.
Yeah, but no one's against killing viruses, for the record.
That is true. And so it was a fascinating exchange. I want to play a couple of clips.
Sure.
And just, like, I don't know, get your take on what was going on there. And I liked how it started getting heated at one point, like where
lots of points.
Well, I also liked how he had his briefing book sitting there and didn't seem to be, like, listening to what you're saying. He's just going through the different facts that his team had assembled for him, which in some instances were actually not really facts.
Oh, for sure.
But let's play this part. This is the infant mortality rates in that you guys are debating in the context of your argument over abortion. Let's play this.
Maybe you're correct.
That's okay. So as soon as it comes out of the womb, it is living.
That is correct. If it's alive when it comes out of the womb, we don't know, right? A lot of babies die at childbirth. That's why you don't know until
they're
born.
Well, not a lot of babies die at childbirth.
Yeah, a lot.
Very, very low percentage.
Can someone Google that for me, please? Can you please Google how many babies die at childbirth every year?
We have some of the lowest childbirth mortality rates in the world, thankfully.
No, we do not. We have some of the highest. We have some of the highest. United States infant mortality rate places us 16th among the nations of the world.
How many nations
Thousands
are there?
Thousands of then? Infants die each year because of inadequate medical care that you often vote against and don't support.
I'm not an elected official.
But you support things and you have the influence of millions. You don't have a vote? Are you suppressing your own vote now too, or just others?
Are you saying that I vote in Congress?
I'm saying that you vote in elections and you decide who goes to Congress, do you not? And do you not support bills or not support bills based on your massive influence?
I think you do. You're getting really worked up.
No, I'm not.
So let me ask you a question.
Also, we rank 33 out of 36 in the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development Nations, OECD nations, ranked by U.S. News and World Report for prenatal and early childhood care that you often do not support. In fact, recently, when Biden suggested just $225 billion to support children more in the early years of their lives, you went against it and said, oh, capping it, while theoretically you paid empty lip service to it and said, well, theoretically it's a good idea, $225 billion is so expensive and it caps the amount they can spend on their children at 7% of income a year. And by doing that, there's no incentives then for them to seek cost-effective care. When you had no problem with Donald Trump spending $8 trillion, giving trillions and trillions of tax cuts to millionaires and billionaires, and raising the national debt to $27 trillion.
Can I be
no
honest,
issue with that. But helping the kids that you care about so much, the babies you care about so much, that you want to force women to give birth to them, and then they can go f*** themselves once they're born because you don't give a shit, and you vote against it constantly. Bravo! What
honest?
A hill to die on.
I have no idea what the heck you're talking
you
about.
You don't? Well, you went on
okay,
the record.
Okay, let's pause it.
Oh!
I mean, the he didn't seem to like that part. That's he was sort of like fishing around through his notebook looking for something to respond to.
He needed some way to like moor himself because he was just getting a little bit discombobulated, I think.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. I think it's amazing how these supposed America First people always want America to be just number one. Number two will not do. Except when it comes to the thing that they're forcing, and then 16th is totally fine. How many countries are there, Ben? There's plenty of third world countries we could compete with. Compared to those places, we're doing fine with babies dying that we're forcing to be born. It's an insane logical inconsistency, but they don't care about that because, lucky for them, their followers don't have the critical faculties to see these inconsistencies. They just go on the feeling of the vibe of what he's of the hateful rhetoric he's putting out there.
I mean, to be fair, I have seen a couple of rallies with the USA chants and we're number 16. just to be fair about that.
They're willing to throw our country really way down the list of priorities as soon as it has a chance to own a lib. I mean, if you remember the people at Trump's rallies wearing shirts that saying, I'd rather be Russian than a Democrat. Instantly, even our adversaries, they would much rather be on the side of our longtime, like, caricaturized adversaries. I mean, from the Rocky movies on, they'd rather be on that team than be on the team that's fighting for the people that they actually are. Much more represented in their way of life is the Democrats fighting for the guys that are not the uber wealthy, but the guy with the t-shirt voting, rallying for I guess, turning on our country is totally fine.
Well, the thing, they may not count some of those statistics in the infant mortality rates, or it doesn't register in their minds, because often babies that die at a disproportionate rate are either black or non-white, and they are poor. So for them, it's like, well, you know, maybe not something that they necessarily think about too often.
Yeah, that was another amazing part in the debate is Charlie, he had all these moments that he thought were going to be gotcha moments against me that I think I quickly flipped because I was very prepared and I have, I think, just kindness and care on my side, which certainly helps. He reads a statistic of the number of black potential babies that are aborted every year and he says, are you okay with this? See, I want more black babies, Ben, and you want less. And I go, I want the exact number of black babies that the black community itself wants to have. Who are you? Charlie Kirk gets to decide how many black babies there should be? It's just an insane level of hubris and pompousness to even have that opinion, let alone speak it in words.
He has a finely tuned baby ratio that he wants That's right. to implement.
Well, that, you know, that moment struck me too, because I think, you know, I'm curious as to what you thought that Charlie Kirk, you know, I mean, and look, you know, I participate in debates like this, and they're rarely, well, maybe never. I mean, these type of debates, never about convincing the other person, right? It is about how you want your audience and the person you're debating's audience, you know, what you want to achieve with those people. And certainly from Charlie Kirk's perspective, the idea of being able to say to his people, you're not only right in your feelings about abortion, but you're actually anti-racist by being anti-abortion. I mean, that is something that really, it's like almost like a currency for the people who look at Charlie Kirk. Like any opportunity for me to say, like, I'm protecting black people in some way has some value. What else do you think his agenda was in this? Like, were there moments where you're debating where he's like, okay, yeah, this is a meme, this is a narrative that he wants people to walk away with?
I think that he just wanted an opportunity, and maybe that's his goal with the whole debate series he's doing, is just to have a chance to reinforce the exact talking points that he's been feeding people for a long time. And I think, I mean, I don't want to call myself what he thought would be an easy target. He's offered a lot of people. He offered famously Eric Swalwell to do the same debate. And instead of replying to the DM that Kirk slid into, Swalwell blasted the DM and said, I won't go debate an insurrectionist who makes my kids unsafe by voting against school shooting laws to protect our kids. I instead got the exact same copied and pasted DM, and I said yes and said it to his face and even called him out on being an insurrectionist at the end. I think that he, and by the way, that's a clip that he certainly cut out of his broadcast of it, but I just think he wanted a chance to own me in front of his people, and he didn't know what to do when that wasn't the case. You know, I take it very seriously because I'm going there speaking on behalf of women, which I've not been sanctioned to do, so I at least wanted to do them proud as I could. So I studied very hard for this. I met with Narrell. I was advised by a friend at Planned Parenthood. I wanted to make sure that I really knew what I was talking about when I went in there and was at least presenting the opinions that I think would make these groups that this issue affects most proud. And I don't think he expected it. I think it's very clear, like you said, with his notebook, that he just constantly wanted to move on to his next talking point. Because for another example, in addition to wanting to dictate for the black community what they do, he never ever speaks about the mother. He never speaks about the effect on the human being that is then being forced to bring this child into the world and then raise it for 18 plus years. And so I said, look how you never focus on the mother. You clearly don't care at all about the mother. And he literally goes, oh, I do. I care about the mother so much that I want to talk about this. And then change topics to adoption and didn't say a word about the mother. Literally, almost like rotely in his brain, when just kind of spewing out in between words, he showed his lack of care. He's let's change topics.
He may have been a little bit cocky. Oh, go ahead, Matt.
He said, I care so much that we support cops, the border, and charter schools.
Yes. That's his big plan.
Well, this is a little bit off topic, but you mentioned, like, you know, he cut something out of his broadcast. I mean, we're going to play that clip. What were the terms? Were you able to go in and say, like, I'm not doing this unless I get my own live feed? Is that it?
Oh, yes. I negotiated this pretty heavily before I went in there because I'm pretty familiar with, you know, what they can do and what his plan might be to with multiple cameras to edit it and make me look bad. So I negotiated that they could not cut any content out. They could just trim a little bit of fat for time, which they didn't even do because I didn't give them any fat. I had final cut approval before they released it, and I was able to bring my own camera and shoot it and have the right to release my own footage.
That was smart.
As well. Nice. So I was able to make sure that they weren't able to mess with me at all.
Did you guys didn't address, I mean, you say the mother, but like there was no addressing of, like, okay, from a practical matter, how many mothers and doctors would you put into jail? I mean, presumably, if he's talking, like, I can't remember the figure that he said of 30 million, Well, actually, let's play this clip. Let's play this clip where he talks about this Holocaust that has taken place. This, again, is another one of those things where his supporters can feel like they are, you know, it's a never forget moment for them. They're going to remember the Holocaust. They're just going to remember the other Holocaust too that they have dubbed the Holocaust. But here is Kirk saying,
"You were in the womb." Uh-huh. What does it say in Leviticus about unborn children?
Oh, wow! Somebody wrote that I knew you before you're in the womb.
Yes, somebody called Jeremiah, a minor character in the Bible.
The Bible's beautiful, but it's allegories. So if you're going to take the specific words and say it's some kind of scientific book, it's not a scientific book. It's a good moral guide.
No, it's the word of God, Ben.
In your opinion. But you can't enforce your religious opinion on the world. That's why on the country especially.
I've been making secular arguments.
Sure.
So I'm just asking, as someone who says you were offended by the Holocaust, where millions of Jews were killed, why are you seemingly indifferent with the millions of Americans that are being killed?
Because they're not Americans. You have to be born on U.S. soil to be an American. Again, you prove my point.
No,
thank you.
Human beings.
The definition of an American is being born on U.S. soil. Born.
So
born or naturalized.
Let me ask you,
are killed every year
through
abortion.
Question.
Thank you. Another point.
The Black Panthers.
In my column. Love
the
it.
The Black Panthers said, which I disagree with the Black Panthers on a lot, but they said that abortion is a black genocide on the community.
Good for them.
Are they wrong?
Yeah, they're of course wrong.
I wonder how many times Charlie Kirk cites the Black Panthers as a guiding light for what we should be doing in the context of American politics.
Grasping at straws at that point. He's like, listen, a group I disagree with and hate very much, they once said, that didn't work, all right.
I also think it was pretty interesting that, I mean, it was funny to watch Charlie's face when you were talking about the Bible being an allegory, because, you know, ultimately it is a religious edict, right? I mean, this is, and that is, they attempt to obscure that. Charlie Kirk said himself right there, like, I'm making secular arguments, but we all know at the end of the day, it is because their interpretation of a book that they believe is the word of God is what drives this. And I think they want to obscure that, because I think that is the least effective stance they have for anybody who is not a fundamentalist religious person. I mean, I think that's just the bottom line.
Absolutely. And not just that, I then brought up the point, if we're gonna be influenced by our religions, the whole point is that you can't, I touched on it there, but we got into it more in depth, is that you can't choose which religion that will be. I'm a Jewish person, and the Jewish religion tends to much more favor in its teachings the wishes of the mother, and that life doesn't begin until the first breath. And then he tried to correct me about what my own religion says, which is amazing. Charlie Kirk knows all the things, all the religions, but it just always shows how there's no consistency, and it doesn't truly actually come, I don't even think, from a religious belief. It's just, that's just the origin of where they get the idea, really. And I called him out on this too. Really, this is just a wedge issue that they use to gain more followers and to keep us separated. In the pre-Roe versus Wade times, the big issue that they used in this way to get emotional response from people and to keep communities of color down and to keep their followers on an emotional hook was segregation. They were, the Republican Party then was pro-segregation. And when the country shifted off of that topic and that became obvious that that was no longer morally acceptable to the vast majority of people, they then, after Roe v. Wade, shifted and decided to make abortion that major emotional wedge issue that conveniently gets to keep communities of color down, keep women down, tell them what to do with their own bodies, while at the same time, my dog just walked in, while at the same time also not, also just manipulating people into continuing to be latched onto their every word, because that's a great way to play to people's emotions and not actually care about the people. You actually said a minute ago, too, he said about how many mothers would he want to be in jail and how many doctors. So that was an interesting point, too, that he never responded to. And this is the one of the few points I really couldn't pin him down on, because he just kept moving on. But he keeps saying that abortionists should be in jail and they're murderers. And I said, do you have any friends that have had abortions, Charlie? And he goes, yes, I do. And I pray for them. And I'm like, so why are you friends with murderers, Charlie? And he goes, no, because the woman always is manipulated and is not given the real facts and isn't shown ultrasounds. I'm like, never? She's never shown an ultrasound? A woman has never made a decision for an abortion just because she can't afford a baby or isn't ready. It's never happened. And he goes, look, I feel bad for them, but the abortionists are the ones that should be in jail. And I said, Charlie, if you hire a hitman to kill somebody else, are you not a murderer? And he wouldn't answer. I asked him that 5 times. If you hire a hitman, are you not also guilty of murder? And he wouldn't answer because there's no logical consistency.
Well,
he
they can't. They can't maintain that logical consistency because they know that at that point, what's going to happen is that the American public is going to understand it. It turns the focus back onto the mothers. For Charlie Kirk to make those statements that there are millions upon millions upon millions of American women who do not have the capacity to know what they're doing in this instance, that they're complete dupes in this regard. I mean, according to Charlie Kirk, I don't know what else. If you as a person do not know what you're doing when you decide to not carry a pregnancy to term, I wonder what you are capable of knowing. I mean, honestly, this is a pretty big deal for people, and particularly for women. It is, I wonder under Charlie Kirk's rubric, are women, are they able to like, even like, how are they able to like dress themselves? I mean, how are they able to do any of these things?
I'm not able to. I have to have some help in the morning. So, I mean,
Emma just sort of like text me, what are you wearing today?
Mm. Yes.
And then she bases her
one leg at a time. You get the clothes on and somebody hopefully drives you to work.
Yeah.
All right. Exactly. Well, hopefully let's play this last moment, because in the last seconds of the debate, you mentioned something to Charlie Kirk that he did not include on his broadcast, but you did on yours.
You can't infringe on someone's freedom to ask them to wear a mask because it might not spit deadly virus into their face. That's too much of an impingement on freedom for you. But you're okay with rolling back reproductive freedom. You're okay with rolling back voting access in this country. You're okay with broadly undermining our democracy by backing an insurrection literally to overthrow the election of our nation that you supported. I mean, Turning Points literally funded Trump's Jan 6 rally.
So, Ben, I have a question.
That led to an insurrection attempt on our government and the death of many people, including police officers that you claim to love and care for. How do you reconcile being anti-freedom on all of those things and claiming you are pro-freedom?
So, Ben, I have a question. Which one of us was
anti-democracy?
Ben, I have a question. Which one of us was arrested at the Capitol before?
I was.
So you're an insurrectionist?
Oh, no. I didn't break into the building and kill people.
Wait, were you arrested?
Yeah,
Where was I on January 6th?
You were doing a podcast in which you said, I'm getting 500 emails a minute of people saying, we want civil war, ginning that up.
You were arrested at the Capitol.
Not that day.
And I was in Phoenix, Arizona.
And you also sent busloads of people to the Capitol on Jan 6.
How do you justify being an insurrectionist?
You sent people to the Capitol on Jan 6 for the insurrection.
You really should get better research.
Are you not responsible?
Because our students never got near the Capitol.
None of them. No.
They were actually at the wall. They were right. They were at the Ellipse.
And none of them
miles away.
None of them walked
into
the Capitol.
But you, as an insurrectionist, who were arrested at the Capitol.
Zero. No.
Because you are a threat to democracy.
I peacefully protested and told the Capitol police I would be protesting.
2 years earlier.
It was respectful and it was civil disobedience.
I did not know that you were a domestic terrorist.
So you do take blame for the insurrection that happened on Jan
6? I take no blame. That's slanderous and wrong.
Why do you take no blame for it? You sent buses of people there.
To the Ellipse that got nowhere near the Capitol. You're the insurrectionist.
But that day that you ginned up.
That is libelous and slanderous, and you know it.
That day that you
ginned up. So what's the final question you have here?
That day that you ginned up.
I ginned up nothing.
That day that you ginned up.
Lie. You're the only one that got arrested.
You said you were sending patriots to fight.
I said nothing like that.
You've never said
sending buses ginning up.
And you said they want a civil war.
This is so typical of the left.
A civil war.
Where you come in here and you yourself have been arrested at the Capitol.
Peaceful,
and you try to say
protest.
That I am something
that's
not. You are a domestic terrorist.
Wait, okay.
A failed presidential candidate no one's ever heard of.
So you're
and
not,
you have the balls to come in here and try to call me that.
So no, you're not responsible for it?
Let me come.
Who's asking that? That's my last question.
Not even close.
You're not responsible for what happened on January 6th?
But you have actually been arrested on the Capitol.
Okay,
let me finish and say this. This right here is exactly why we're not going to come together as a nation or this. You dishonestly come in here with poorly researched talking points where
perfectly
I was 2,000 miles away
from Phoenix, Arizona.
You can't
incite a mob from a distance?
Let me be very clear. You're the one that's actually been arrested before.
Yeah.
I have not, nor peaceful students, protest. And they got nowhere near.
None of them.
And let me just finish by saying this. You're done.
This is exactly why no one trusts
half the country.
I promise.
Because they dishonestly lie about this and they think they got one.
But this is all cut, right? This is not on his.
So this was on. He ends it right after this.
He's been arrested.
And then when he gets up, he didn't air any of this.
I promise.
For a great debate. Thank you guys so much.
I promise you my last sentence.
Thank you.
This all is not on. I'm here.
If you're not responsible for what happened on Jan 6,
thank
is
you.
That because unintended consequences happened that you didn't anticipate?
I hope that
kind of like up. Mothers that have an unintended pregnancy, they didn't anticipate. So if you want to cut some slack for Jan 6, maybe you could cut women some slack.
Thank
who
you.
Who unintendedly get pregnant.
Thank
Does that
you.
Sound like a deal?
You're the domestic terrorist.
I was peaceful protesting, my friend.
Thank you. Domestic terrorist.
You ginned up an insurrection
That's
on
That's so
on
fun.
Country.
That's good.
Oh, he was big mad. He was real mad there. You got him.
I mean, he also must have anticipated the question, right? And because that's why he did his research on your protest activities.
Yes, which just to clarify, that's the one thing I regret that I was so caught off guard by that. I didn't make very clear. It was literally in 2019 during my presidential campaign in a planned act of civil disobedience that I went with Represent Us as part of a 900-mile march or 700 miles from Atlanta to D.C. that Ronaldo Pearson did, and I joined for the last mile, and we told the Capitol Police we were protesting corruption in government and trying to get lobbyist money out and trying to stop voter suppression, and we told the cops, and we sat in, and they said, if you don't stand up, you'll be arrested, and we did that. We didn't stand up, and we got arrested, and it was coordinated with the police.
Peaceful civil disobedience. I mean, people understand the difference between that. Well, listen, Ben.
And so let me just say quickly, so then he tries to hover over me and intimidate me, and I think the point at the end there, even though it's a little bit of a mixed message, is I think so good, because if you're going to literally carelessly support an overthrow of an election, an overthrow of our government, and not take responsibility for so closely, if not directly, encouraging these people to storm the Capitol building, to not certify an election, and you are not responsible for that unintended consequence, as you claim, it just doesn't make sense for such a large thing to say you have no blame. But for an everyday thing that happens millions of times a year, somebody gets pregnant by accident, to not understand that maybe you should be able to have a way out of that situation if you're not ready for it. It's always a sad instance when an abortion happens. It's not done lightly, but it's something that the woman should be able to choose between herself and her doctor. And that should be, I think, pretty darn clear.
Yeah, I mean, I just on that last point, like, I just got to say from my perspective, like, it isn't always a sad instance on an abortion. I mean, nobody likes to go to the doctor. I don't. But I don't think it's in many respects any sadder than getting your appendix out in certain instances. I mean, for some people, I have no doubt that it is that it can be a hard decision to make but one of timing. But I don't know that it's always necessarily sad. Frankly, I know a lot of people who have had abortions, and to the extent that they were sad about it, it was, you know, there's been a whole host of things in their life that they're actually genuinely sad about, and that's not generally one of them. But
people get sad about a lot of stuff. You get sad about TV show stuff. I still miss my appendix, and I write letters to it, but that's me, you know.
There you go. Ben, what? Where can people find you, find your show, or what would you like to plug?
Sure. Thanks so much for having me. It's been really cool to be on this show. You guys do amazing work. You can follow me at Ben Glebe on all social media, very active on Twitter and Instagram. I have a show that just dropped yesterday on Disney Plus called Just Beyond. I'm an actor in that show. I play a ghost in episode 6. My game show Idiot Test is on Game Show Network on the weekends and Pluto TV. You can watch season 1 of it there. And I have a virtual comedy club I created during the pandemic so people can actually have live entertainment from the safety of their own home. Live audience, live laughter. You see and hear everybody. It's called NowhereComedyClub.com, NowhereComedyClub.com for tickets to all the shows, other comedians, not just me. And I do a weekly show there called Glebe Off the Top, Crowdwork and Improvised Madness, where you're part of our community. We elect a mayor, and I just go nuts and improvise with you and play characters. And it's really fun. You can get tickets to all of that at NowhereComedyClub.com or my website, BenGlebe.com.
Busy.
Awesome.
Busy.
Very, very busy.
Appreciate it, Ben. Thanks for coming on.
It's totally my pleasure. Oh, sorry, one last, it's a million plugs, I'm sorry, but also have an in-person tour. I'm coming soon to Phoenix and Dallas and Valencia this weekend and Vancouver. So if you want to come see me in person, I'll also benglebe.com for my Descent into Madness tour. That was too many plugs, I'm sorry.
No, I like them all. Appreciate it. All right, thanks again, Ben.
My pleasure.
Congratulations, too. Appreciate the work you did there with Charlie Kirk. That
was thanks. Fun to
watch. My pleasure.
All right. It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb, but finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I guess somewhere the choice is made, the option where you don't get paid.